So my best jokes won't make it into the record for posterity. That's too bad. Okay, those weren't that good of jokes.
Mr. Chair, number one is called to order.
Yeah, okay. We ready, Greg?
Yes, sir, we are.
All right, the meeting of the New Mexico Commission for the Blind will come to order on this fourth day of June, and we're doing it virtually. Thanks to everybody, and especially the staff, cooperation, because we couldn't do this without all that staff. Audrey, Kelly, Greg, you name everybody, and that's how we're able to do all of this. And thanks to the commissioners, Urja Lansing and Robert Reedy, for their cooperation. But the meeting is underway.
Two is roll call.
First is roll call. Robert Reedy.
Present.
Urja Lansing.
Here.
Arturo Schreiber here. We're all here today.
Introduction of guests and staff.
Okay, I'm sorry, what did you say, Urja?
Introduction of guests and staff.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to do that here. So this is Greg Trapp, Executive Director. We should have on with us Jim Salas, our Deputy Director for VR and IL. Jim, you there?
Yes, sir. Good morning, everybody.
Excellent.
And we should have Kevin Romero, our Deputy Director for Finance Administration. Kevin?
Good morning, everyone.
And we should have Lucy Malahan, our Orientation Center Director. Lucy, you there?
He has not yet arrived.
All right. We should have Trish Adams. Trish, you there?
I'm here.
All right. And of course, we have Kelly Burma, our Skills Center Coordinator. Kelly?
Good morning, everyone.
And helping also Kelly's co-hosting this and hosting this is Audrey Trujillo. Audrey, say hello.
Good morning.
Good morning. Audrey, is my camera on?
No. So if you want to go ahead and do Alt-V, if you want to turn
that.
It on.
All right. Now I can wave everybody. So hopefully you can see me. And of course, we have John Kreienkamp, our Assistant Attorney General. John, thank you for joining us.
Morning, everybody.
Hi, John.
And staff, have I left anyone out? Doesn't think sound like it. So now we can introduce guests. Any guests?
You still don't have video, Greg.
I don't.
I sent you a request, so we'll try that.
Oh, I know what I need to do.
You could walk out and talk.
All right, now do we have it?
I can't do it now.
No, sir.
That's strange.
I'm sorry, what was that, Greg?
Oh, I was just trying to start my video here just so that I can be on camera, but it doesn't seem to be cooperating with us. Let me try one more time. Okay, let me try now.
I can turn my video off. I'm not important.
Oh, you can keep it on. Do I have my camera now? You have to keep it on, Kelly.
And Ms. Malahan has entered the room.
Lucy, thank you for joining us here. We're just introducing staff and guests. So.
Thank you.
All right, so I'll work on my camera. It's not the biggest issue in the world, but we'll figure things out. So, Mr. Chairman, we are ready for the approval of the agenda then.
Okay. Do we have a motion?
Yes,
Motion to approve the agenda.
Mr. Chair,
Robert.
This is...
Oh. Wait, Bob, did you start to talk?
This is Bob Brady, and I move we approve the minutes of the regular meeting of April 23rd, 2020.
Burgess second.
We're slightly ahead. Mm-hmm. We'll do the agenda, approval of the agenda first.
Yeah, so. I assume his answer was yes, was it?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, approval of the agenda moved by Bob Reedy. Is there a second?
I urge a second.
All right. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Mr. Chairman, as a reminder, we, great. So all of us are speaking. We were all speaking at the same time. Just we'll do this as a roll call vote, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, roll call vote. Urge Lansing.
Yes.
Robert Reedy.
Yes.
And Shriver, yes. Okay. Next item is the minutes of the meeting, correct?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, okay. I'm sorry, I don't have the date, though.
So
it's April 23rd.
I'll let you help, Art. You've got it there, so I will stop jumping
well,
in. Urge you can be there.
Pitch in later, Greg. I'm going to do my best.
Okay, you're doing great. I'll be quiet.
So, Mr. Chair, it is the approval of April 23rd. Urge moves to approve the minutes of the regular meeting of April 23rd, 2020.
All
Bob
right.
Reedy, second.
Is there a second?
Bob Reedy, second.
All right. Any corrections, additions, et cetera? Hearing none. All those in favor say yeah, aye. Well, we have a roll call. We have to take a roll call vote, don't we, Greg?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay. Roll call. Urge.
Yes.
Bob Reedy.
Yes.
Shriver, yes. Okay. Approved.
Number six is the chairman's report.
Okay. Once again, I want to thank the commissioners for your cooperation in working with us on these trying times, and also the staff. I just can't, and on behalf of the commission, I can't say enough. For Greg and his supervisors, as well as all the staff, for what they have done, are doing, and continuing to do under very, very difficult circumstances in handling all the things that have to be done with the commission. And also, you know, right in the middle of all this came our special session of the legislature, which had to be done because of what here we had a great time in the last session, and suddenly we didn't have any money, and that was very difficult, and so our thanks to, again, all the staff for the cooperation and working with DFA, as well as all the legislative branches that were required to handle what went on. And our congratulations to Greg and the staff for coming out of this in very, and I think, very good condition compared to what could have been. That's my report. Any questions, anybody? Any discussion? Hearing none, Greg will have your report.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Commissioners, welcome. I appreciate everyone for joining us here. We are having our first actual Zoom meeting. I just regret that my camera is not working for some reason. Audrey, is it still off? So, you don't get to see me here, so I'm really sorry about that.
Can I
interrupt for 1 second and just ask who just joined so that I can give a name to the recording? It's a 615 area code.
That'd be Lucy.
I thought I had named her, and it's, for whatever reason, it's not taking it when I do it, Audrey.
You have her in there twice, so I just...
Oh, it's in there twice? That's weird.
Yeah, so let me try... I can't. Okay, I see. Because I just don't want the phone number to display. Okay. I got it here.
Audrey, the first time I called, I wasn't able to get through, so I had to call back again.
Okay.
Made a connection.
So it shows one connection and then another phone connection. So... I think we're okay now because your phone connection is the one that's activating when you speak. So. Okay, we're good.
All right, so this is obviously a new and challenging time, and some of these little electronic Zoom meeting glitches are to be expected, and they're a little bit inevitable. But that's why we have in the agenda and on the notice information about how people who are having difficulty connecting can ask for assistance. We've got multiple ways that people can connect. We're trying to really do all we can to make sure that this information is available and accessible to the public and open. And there'll be more on that on the agenda here later. It's a challenge for us all, but we're certainly doing our best. And Mr. Chairman, I will definitely echo your comments. Really, it's our staff that make this all possible. We're very, very fortunate to have such a good team, and I do thank everyone for all of their work here. We are continuing in what really has become an extraordinary, exceptional time. None of us had ever expected this to happen. We are all dealing with new circumstances, and I think the staff has really responded beautifully here to this. We're providing services in a way that is new and creative and innovative, and I think that that's really owing to the efforts of the staff and all that we've been able to do to support our staff and our mission. So commissioners, you are rightfully proud of the job that this agency is doing. I think that we are definitely providing services in the absolute most uninterrupted way that we can. Clearly the coronavirus has a life of its own. We are watching things on a daily basis and making decisions based upon what we see as some of the trends. That's definitely going to continue to be the case for much, much longer, I think, than any of us thought just 2 or 3 months ago. Clearly, this is a long-term situation that we're going to be in. Hopefully, we will have a vaccine, and hopefully, things can be mitigated here in about a year or so. But even after that, I think it's going to be with us for a while to come. So we'll be dealing with this. We have been touched here personally by the coronavirus. I want to extend my condolences to Lucy Malahan and Francis Malahan over the loss of Lucy, your brother-in-law. Had the privilege of meeting him. He was a fine individual, and certainly we send you our condolences there.
Thank you.
It is ironic that this is happening on the 100th anniversary of the Vocational Rehabilitation Act. I am hoping to have a guest column appear in the Albuquerque Journal here sometime this week. I authored it in conjunction with Diane Morning Brown, and part of that column points out the irony of the fact that it was 100 years ago that we had the VR program, but we were also still dealing with the third wave of the 1918 flu. So here we find ourselves in that situation of irony. We did come out of the 1918 flu. We will come out of this one. We will be successful. The VR program was a great success, and the last 100 years have definitely shown that. As Chairman Schreiber mentioned, we just completed the special session. We'll hear more from Mr. Romero on that, but briefly, we had a 4% cut. That works out to about $96,000. However, that is taken off of our $312,500 increase. So we will end up with about a $215,000 increase as we start this next budget year here on July 1st. That's the good news, and that will remain the good news. It's not as much as we had hoped for. Obviously, we had requested $600,000, but given the circumstances we're all in, I am quite thrilled to have the budget increase that we're looking at. However, we can anticipate in the regular session come January some additional cuts. It's obviously going to depend upon what's taking place with the economy, the recovery, the price of oil and natural gas. That's all going to be really key in determining what's going to happen in the regular session next year. Part of the special session included the passage of House Bill 5, which creates a 9-person Civil Rights Commission. We did provide bill analysis on that. That commission will look at the doctrine of qualified immunity. It is something that could potentially impact on us. We have programs that do entail a bit of risk. The cane travel programs, the industrial art programs, the cooking programs all come with some element of risk. So depending upon how wide in scope the recommendations are, those might have the potential to impact us. We cannot eliminate every element of risk from our training. If we did that, our training would really not have any value. The Civil Rights Commission will be really looking at deprivation of constitutional rights, but one of the provisions is a little bit more broad than that. Section F would call upon the Civil Rights Commission to look at state laws that could potentially impact on us. And I would ask Mr. Krankamp if he has anything to add there. The Attorney General's office also provided some very helpful analysis on this.
I do not have anything to add on that, not at this time. I know that when we were doing bill analysis, that was something that was reviewed by our office, but I personally was not involved in that. This is going to be an item at a division meeting for my personal division. I don't know if we're going to end up representing the Civil Rights Commission or how that's going to go. So I don't really have any inside information at this time.
Thank you, John. Part of our commentary was, you know, based on our experience with our own commission, we know that there are costs associated with it, that we publish notices, we have obligations to provide for accommodations for the public and members to participate. The bill did not provide for a budget, so that could be an issue. We did point out that since this appears to be an advisory commission, that there would likely not be Open Meetings Act coverage, but certainly this is an issue of great public interest, and We want to encourage transparency. Because the commissioners also receive a per diem, they would be covered by the Governmental Conduct Act. And we'd also pointed that out in our analysis. And I appreciate Kevin helping to get that. It always seems that these analysis requests come at the worst possible time and with the most difficult possible deadlines. So Kevin and I were working late Friday night and Saturday night getting those in. So Kevin, thank you very much.
Greg, can I just jump in on one small thing?
Yeah.
I would just push back on one small item that you just mentioned in terms
sure,
of
absolutely.
whether the commission will be subject to the Open Meetings Act.
Yeah.
So I'm imagining that our office will be looking at that, but the longstanding position of the Office of the Attorney General is that when a public body is created by statute, then they are going to be subject to the Open Meetings Act. I have some questions about that longstanding view myself, just from a legal standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
But that is the longstanding position of my office. And so my guess is that if I was a betting man, I would say that we would be very likely to take the position that they would be subject to the Open Meetings Act. So they probably would have to meet notice and agenda requirements.
That is very interesting. I think that is excellent. Our commentary certainly did encourage transparency and discussed the cost of notices and that. I did not see that commentary from the AG's office in there. And it might have been provided. Not all of the commentary makes it into the analysis requests that are distributed. So, but we certainly do encourage that same kind of openness and transparency. So it's good to know that the Civil Rights Commission would be covered by the Open Meetings Act. So that would definitely be a factor that they'll need to look at then. So we are also, I apologize, my phone is ringing. I will put that on to vibrate. So we are also in the period of submitting comment to new regulations for pre-employment transition services. The Department of Education reopened the comment period. We don't really know why. I am hopeful that that will give us some additional opportunity to encourage greater flexibility. I think that they are looking at the reality of the pandemic and the impact on pre-ed's expenditures, and I'm hopeful that they will give us some additional flexibility here or actual regulatory reform that will more clearly define what our spending can be made in terms of what is allowable for pre-employment transition services. I worked very closely with the National Council of State Agencies for the Blind. The NCSAB president created a committee. I was one of three members of that committee, plus Fred Schroeder, our former director and former RSA commissioner. And we developed a pretty complete set of recommended changes or comments for the pre-ed regulations. We are seeing a number of different impacts of the coronavirus. Clearly, Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham is rightly focused on making sure that New Mexicans are safe from the coronavirus. I think that she's done a fantastic job. If we look at what's taking place in states surrounding us, Arizona, Utah, Texas, Oklahoma, the virus is really spreading at very alarming rates. We definitely have some hot spots here in New Mexico and parts of the states that are out of her control, but it is not as bad as the surrounding states. We'll talk more about this later, but one of the impacts, I think, is that it's more difficult to get appointments. The governor and her staff are extraordinarily busy, and getting appointments to boards and councils is at this time a little bit more difficult. We have been working to get appointments for our state rehab council, and we definitely do need additional appointments there. I will continue to be in touch with Melissa Salazar and the governor's office on that. We did have a conversation with the Rehabilitation Services Administration about the creation of a separate commission and the movement to an agency that does not have a state rehabilitation council. In light of the coronavirus, I had considered the possibility of us moving there because we do have a majority of blind persons on our commission. And it appeared to be possible that we could have made that change without having to actually amend the statute. I would still have wanted to regardless, but I think that because of our majority of blind members that we might have been able to. No one had ever been in that position before. We had a conversation with our liaison and others at RSA, Tanya Steller, and basically they have considered this, and their opinion is that because our enabling legislation does not actually prescribe the majority of blind members, that we would not be able to make the change until the statute actually says that a majority of the commissioners must be blind. So that obviously curtails our ability to proceed to a separate commission only. It would have been able to save us all a little bit of time, resources, at a time when we're all incredibly busy. The other thing that came out of that conversation is that we'll need to actually have a handoff of the duties of the council to the commission. So that was a very useful conversation. And I think that as we go into the regular session next year, we will be in a better place to know exactly how to write that legislation. So we'll be working that on that here in the coming months, hopefully getting a sponsor and be able to expand the size of the commission to 5 or perhaps 7 members and have that handoff legislation. Lastly, I want to mention that the Commission for the Blind has a agreement with the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation. Part of that agreement addresses the issue of our pool of hearing officers. We have a shared pool of hearing officers. DVR was able to get an extension on their contract with those hearing officers. So that will continue for another year. Jim will be working with them when they do go through another procurement process. In the meantime, I'm hoping that we'll be able to obtain additional hearing officers so that we can make sure that our consumers have the fullest and fairest right to a fair hearing should that ever be an issue. Fortunately, we've never had a fair hearing request, but it's a right that's available to them, and we want to make sure that that right is always fully and fairly available to them. So, Mr. Chairman, that is my part of the director's report. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Greg. Any questions, commissioners? Hearing none, we move on to
administration and finance.
Mr. Kevin Romero.
Good morning, commissioners, and everyone else attending the meeting. I hope everybody's having a good day so far. Starting off, I'd like to start off with some good news for fiscal year 20. The commission has done, I feel, an excellent job in managing its budget, and we're approaching year end in next week on Tuesday. Based on that information, The agency is, or the commission is planning to close out fiscal year 20 with roughly 13.8% of our budget remaining, which is a little less than $1.8 million, which is fairly good. Taking into consideration that we did have COVID-19, which did impact some expenses. It did impact some revenue coming in, particularly for the BEP program. So overall, we managed to handle those situations and still operate and maintain within budget. So that's a good thing. As you're all aware, year end is approaching faster than we like. We are on task to meet our deadlines for year end closing as dictated by DFA. We will have all our agreements or our contracts submitted within the specified deadline so that they can be approved and retroactively approved for July 1st. So the commission staff continues to work to make sure that we're ensuring to meet all our deadlines. In regards to fiscal year 20 that we're closing, we've been notified. We do have an auditor already identified for fiscal year 20. It's going to be the Office of the State Auditor. I'm just waiting for the official letter from the State Auditor's Office so I can forward to the DFA controller so he's properly notified. But we already have an identified auditor for this fiscal year. Moving on from fiscal year 20 finances, in regards to our human resources status, currently we have, I just want to make sure I get this number correct. We have submitted 8 hiring freeze exemptions, of which 4 of them have already been approved and 3 of them are still currently advertised. One of them, the advertisement closed on the 16th, which was for the HR position here in Santa Fe. We have 4 awaiting approval from State Personnel Office and DFA. Those 4 are for 2 office admins in Albuquerque, 1 office admin at the Orientation Center, and a rehab counselor in Farmington. As soon as we receive approval from State Personnel and DFA, as well as the governor's office on those exemptions, we will move forward with advertising and recruitment for those positions. Is there any questions so far? None? Okay. As Greg had stated before, or in his report, special session did close Monday. House Bill 1 was passed. It's awaiting governor's signature. The impact of House Bill 1 on the commission is as follows. We did get a reduction of $96,000 within House Bill 1 of general fund. That translates roughly to a, got the information here, I was working on it. So out of the $312,000 that we received during the regular session, we're going to maintain $216,500 of that as a general fund increase. So we managed to make it out fairly well. We did come out with an increase. However, the $96,000 does have an impact. I try to minimize it as much as possible and identify the areas it would have the least amount of impact. Still working through those numbers, but I believe the impact's minimal according to our numbers at this point. That being said, our budget was initially, which the commission approved, was a budget of $13,890,700 with the necessary adjustments for the 4% reduction. Our budget drops to $13,653,000. The additional reduction other than the 96,000 is House Bill 1 also stripped the entire compensation appropriation for all agencies. What was written in instead was a 1% salary increase for staff making less than $50,000. And the way the wording in the language was, it's a special appropriation to DFA. So they're expecting agencies to absorb the 1% hit. And if they're unable to absorb it in their operating budget, then they can seek a portion of that special appropriation from DFA. So that also adds to the decrease. We wouldn't be getting the entire appropriated amount for compensation increase, which does bring the total budget down. That being said, our actual vacancy factor for 21, based on the sanding that's awaiting approval, would mean that the commission would have to maintain a 10.2% vacancy rate just to maintain budget. That's manageable at the commission. Currently, we are running a 24.19% vacancy rate at the commission. So we do have room for hiring. We do have room to fill some of these positions. And we still have leverage so that, you know, we're not going to run out of projected funding, assuming that the rest of our revenue sources come in as expected. So that's the impact that happened in during the special session in regards to the commission. One of the things discussed, and I heard this while hearing committee hearings as well as floor session, is for preparing for the January 2021 session, the HAFC chair, Representative Lindstrom, made it clear that the HAFC will be asking agencies to look very deeply and very thoroughly at their finances and their budget request, because they are expecting to make additional cuts in January. So something that we can plan, or we should start looking at this point, is there any place that maybe we, you know, aren't performing to, you know, that we can better improve on, which I'm not finding very many cases. And if we're performing to our best level possible, ensure that we have justification to back up our budget request, because based on her comments, they're going to be quite thorough and quite strict in reviewing these budget requests come January. I just wanted to give a heads up to the commission that this is what has been said and what's kind of expected. I've reached out to DFA, our DFA liaison or representative, asked how are they going to plan on implementing the sanding cuts now that they've been approved. I mean, now that they've been passed. I'm waiting a response if they're expecting an amended budget, which would be very tight deadline, or if they're just going to make adjustments during fiscal year 21. Are there any questions?
Kevin, I want to thank you for really keeping an eye on the special session and helping us to anticipate what's going to take place here. Definitely, I think we can expect some additional cuts next year. Hopefully, the economy will recover and they won't be as bad, but we will really have to watch that very closely, as Kevin has said.
Greg, also, one of the good factors for the commission that came out of this was our fund balance wasn't touched. There were some agencies that did have that fund balances that were swept. Fortunately for ourselves, we were able to maintain our fund balance and our non-reverting language, which was a plus. So I think overall the commission as an entity came out fairly well and fairly unscathed during this special session. I can't say the same for the upcoming session, but I think the planning done by the commission, the support shown within the commission and by those we assist, and by your leadership and the commission's leadership, We've done a really good job of creating a strong reputation with our legislators and our senators, and they understand the job we perform and the reason we make our request for funding. So I think we have a pretty strong case already starting out the door with everybody's hard work.
Thank you, Kevin.
Mr. Chair, this is Urja.
Yes.
So, Kevin and Greg, am I accurate that when they held this special session, there was nobody from the commission was there to offer any input? Is that true? They just made the changes that they made.
Commissioner Lansing, there was a opportunity for public comment. I think we have seen just today, in fact, in the journal, there's an editorial about the lack of public participation going into the special session because it was going to be streamed online and because there are ways in which the public would be able to participate and we could access that as well. There's some thinking that there would be a great increase in public awareness, but that actually turned out not to be the case. Representative Ingloff has said that he is hoping to never have to do this again. I think that it was a disappointment. So I think that part of what we're looking at here, though, was an understanding that the state budget was going to be cut. I think there was really nothing that we could have done to have curtailed the cut that we did have, even had we participated. So yes, we were not there. We could have offered information, but I think that the whole state was in a situation where we just knew that this cut needed to be done. We did watch it closely. Kevin was in close communication with our analysts, so we had plenty of feedback. And the reality is that we were not impacted nearly as badly as could have been the case. Mm-hmm. They did not take away our non-reversionary language. They did not sweep our fund balance. So, Kevin, do you want to add to that?
The only thing I'd like to add is in while viewing and keeping on top of the session and the committee hearings was the only participants other than the public comments that they did get from the public was primarily from LSC and DFA, and they were working off a framework that was developed between both entities going in, and they pretty much try to maintain to that framework. As Greg had said, you know, we did come out on the plus side of this. It could have been worse, but I think, you know, by providing the information as quickly as we did, by responding as quickly as we did for those bill analysis and the other information that was requested prior to the special session, we made a pretty good case to hold our ground and to request the least amount of impact possible.
Thank you, gentlemen. It just is clearly a statement of the history and the relationship and understanding what the commission does and how efficiently and effectively. So thank you.
I would want to, Mr. Chairman, I would want to give John Kreinkamp opportunity to respond. Just looking at that from a transparency and openness perspective. John, did you have any thoughts about that?
The legislative session,
right?
I mean, I wasn't particularly involved with the session. I know that there was a lot of concern, you know, we looked at it at a very early stage as far as whether it was constitutionally permissible. I mean, I think from an openness perspective, I had hoped that, like you had mentioned earlier, that if we allowed people to attend online, that there would be more people watching and more people participating. I've seen that happen in certain circumstances with open meetings, but obviously it didn't hold true for the legislature. I don't really have too much to add, but I think they were probably about as open as they could have been.
Great, thanks. I just wanted to kind of give you an opportunity. This certainly is a experiment in openness and transparency and a real challenge. So, John, I appreciate all you've done to help us as a state to be more transparent here.
Absolutely. Okay, next item.
Independent living and vocational rehabilitation.
Jim Salas.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the commission. So Kevin did talk a little bit about the exemption requests, exemptions from the hiring freeze. Some of those are positions under my programs. So we're hoping to get those exemptions approved so we can get out and recruit for those. We do have a couple of positions. Again, Kevin mentioned some that had already been approved as exemptions that are being recruited now. We have a VR counselor in Vegas, a VR counselor in Roswell. And in Roswell, of course, we've had a VR counselor there for a number of years, Denise Otero. She's going to be moving to a vacant VR counselor position in Albuquerque. And so we're happy to have Denise on our team. She's our actually most senior VR counselor and does a really super duper job. So she'll be coming to Albuquerque here at the end of July. And we'll be looking, actually I was looking at a list, Kevin sent me a list of some applicants for the Vegas position, and we'll be getting a list for the Roswell position here. We had done some recruiting recently there, and so looking forward to looking at some of those applicants, see if we can find some good candidates for our programs. Juan Haro, as far as independent living program, Juan Haro was hired into that position in January, and he's been working it from Roswell, but the duty station is really Albuquerque. So again, he'll be moving to Albuquerque latter part of July, early August. So we'll be looking forward to having Juan. As far as some of our employment numbers, again, our counselors have been working from home, as you would imagine during this kind of stay-at-home time. But they've still managed to kind of follow up on some of the placements that they had already made. And so as far as the state fiscal year, we have 14 rehab closures, average wage of $18.15 an hour. Daphne had surveyed her counselor team yesterday, and they've identified expect another 6 rehab closures here by the end of June. Usually we have up until the first week or so in July to get the information into the system before we run those final reports. So that should look like more like about 20 closures for state fiscal year 20, which would be great. As far as the federal fiscal year runs through the end of September, we currently have 7 with an average wage of $18.42 an hour, projecting another 4 closures there by the end of September. And as far as folks that are in employment status, we have 31 that are in employment status. And so that was, again, trimmed down by a couple from the initial report that Audrey had pulled a couple days ago, which is, again, we expected something like that here as far as the furloughs and layoffs and cutbacks that a lot of businesses experience now during the stay-at-home order. So that's still not as bad as I thought it was going to be. Again, we originally had 33 in employment status, and now we've only cut back to 31. So I'm actually pretty happy with that. Mr. Chairman, that's my report. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions of Jim? All right, moving on.
Orientation center.
All right, okay.
Hello.
How are you?
I am good, how are you?
Okay, thank you. How's Alamogordo?
Most days it's pretty hot. We had a big storm yesterday. Knocked out the internet, so I was thrilled when I got up this morning and we had it back. But it's a little spotty down here, and we're maintaining our own. So I have a report about the orientation center. We do have everybody teleworking at this point with the exception of our maintenance worker, who's remained on site in order to supervise different projects and complete some projects that are hard to do when the buildings are occupied. And in that vein, the stucco project is complete. So our legacy building has a brand new look, had a facelift, and as I understand it, looks very nice now. So we were thrilled to get that completed. And we're hoping as the rainy season kicks in that we will no longer have leaks over our fire alarm panel.
That's going to be great, Lucy.
It will
no
be.
No more buckets sitting around catching the leaks.
That's true. And I hope you're able to come down and see us and see our new look. Also, since July 1st of 2019, we had 8 students graduate from the Orientation Center, along with 2 staff who were in training. We had no grievances filed in the fiscal year 2020. We have begun working with Step 2020, and that is a virtual event now. We have 28 participants in STEP, and so the Orientation Center instructors are part of that, working alongside some of our blindness skills instructors from the IL program under Jim's watch and Vaughn's watch, and also with the Skills Center under Kelly's direction. So it's a wonderful opportunity for us to collaborate and work more closely with people we don't usually work with. We are providing some what we call mask-to-mask or in-person cane travel lessons once parents or guardians, or if the participants happen to be adults and their own guardians, have consented. And those seem to be going well. So we have 2 vacancies at the center. Kevin alluded to this earlier. We have applied for an exemption to the hiring freeze in order to fill the secretary position. And we have the blindness skills instructor position that is vacant. We are in the process of developing a reopening plan at the center. I've been participating in regular calls with other center directors from around the country since March. It looks like several of them will reopen before we will. And so we're going to take the opportunity to learn from their experiences. While we have been able to expand our service delivery model to provide some virtual training to people, what has been very clear is that virtual training for blindness skill development is inadequate to meet the needs of blind and visually impaired people. So we do understand the importance of getting back to in-person training. So in that process of developing the reopening plan, we will be guided by the governor's directives. We will closely monitor the spread of COVID-19. We will do all that we can to minimize the risk of contraction and spread of the virus. But as we provide these in-person services, we know that we cannot completely eliminate all risks that a person must take. So we want to be very cautious, but understand that the benefits to in-person training are innumerable, and we must get back to in-person training when it is reasonable to do so. So, Mr. Chairman, that's my report.
Thank you, Lucy. Any questions of Lucy? Lucy, we're still looking, didn't you say, for a blind, skill center or skills, is that a blindness manager?
So we have the blindness skills instructor position that had been held by Doug Goodhart, and he had been our industrial arts instructor. We haven't requested an exemption to the hiring freeze for that position as of yet, just simply because we're not at the orientation center. And right now, with having fewer people participating in virtual training, we're able to manage our current caseload. So we're not looking to fill that position just yet.
Okay. Understand.
I hope we get there.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Yes, I was going to ask Lucy, what do the blindness skills instructors do right now, since the in-person training is so important and they can't do that? What do they do?
So we are participating in our Students in Transition to Employment program and providing virtual instruction. So we use a combination of Zoom and phone calls in order to provide instruction from a distance. It's just not the ideal way to provide instruction because there's no opportunity for hand-over-hand or hand-under-hand instruction. So as I demonstrate a particular skill to somebody, that person can't see me, I can't see them to verify that they are, you know, maybe reading Braille with correct hand position. I can guess, I can query, but I can't be really sure that their hands are positioned in a way that they need to perform a particular task. And we do have cane travel instructors who, under certain circumstances, are providing in-person training. Everyone has a mask on, so the instructors have a mask on, the participants have a mask on. Daily wellness screenings are being conducted for the participants and the instructors. And Greg really put together quite a nice consent form to explain the risks associated with in-person provision of services. So they've all signed, those who are participating in those mask-to-mask lessons, as we call them, have signed that consent form. And
okay.
When I speak about...
Yeah, well, thank you. That helps me understand better.
Lucy, did you have something else?
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So I was just, you know, when I speak about the risk of providing virtual training, particularly in the area of cane travel, there are things that we can do on the phone. And as I said, instructors can query, you know, what do you feel? What are you sensing? What's under your feet? Those types of things. But it's just not ideal. At another center in a different state, just before a cane travel lesson commenced, a young man was struck by a vehicle. And after several weeks, he remains in a coma. He did this by deciding to go to a convenience store before the lesson to grab a snack. And there was some question as to where he crossed the road. And he was at home with family. As I understand it, his family member believed he should cross not at the crosswalk, but where there would be a sidewalk on the other side. And they don't know exactly where he crossed. But what we do know is that he was struck by a vehicle. And that is one of the worst things that can happen when you're, you know, teaching someone cane travel. We were able to continue to provide a lot of instruction to our students that we had at the time that we went into a telework model. But those have been established. And so they had their basic training. We could continue their training. But with at least one of our students, we had to discontinue cane travel just because the student was often disoriented and the instructor wasn't there physically to observe what was going on and to help the student reason through and make a different decision that would be safer. So right. My reason for in-person is that we've now proven this. So it helps to justify the importance of orientation centers and in-person training.
Absolutely. Yep. Okay. Any other questions of Lucy? Thank you very much, Lucy. Next item, are we ready for Kelly?
Mr. Chairman, we are, and you will be glad to know that my camera is now working, so everyone can see me.
Oh, doesn't that thrill you?
Well, I don't know how they feel, but I think it's important.
Except that we can only see you from the bridge of your nose down.
Oh, okay. Well, I will adjust my screen. How's
That's
that?
Better.
Okay.
All right. Lucy, for the Skills Center. I'm sorry, Kelly.
Kelly, you're on mute.
I believe we may have lost Kelly.
Did we lose Kelly?
Yeah.
We've lost her.
She may be having trouble. I'll watch and see if she comes back into the waiting room.
Yeah, well, why don't, Mr. Chairman, no, she's just joined us again. Kelly, your timing is exemplary. We're just about to abandon you here.
Yeah, I lost connectivity, so.
That happens to me a lot. Before this.
This is the first time in, well, I lost it yesterday when we had some weather, but.
So, Mr. Chairman, just before Kelly starts, kind of as a procedural thing, and I think this might be good for John to hear. I got some Wi-Fi pods, which have greatly strengthened the strength of my Wi-Fi signals. So before that, I was having a lot of connectivity problems, but I've got Comcast cable, so that. Oh, I think they're about $130 or something, but it's made all the difference in terms of my ability to connect. So, you know, we're all learning and trying to deal with this process. So it's not easy. So, Kelly, go ahead.
Okay. I'm sorry for my bit of absence there, but good morning, Chairman, Commissioners, and colleagues. I hope you are well. As Lucy said, we are in a collaborative effort with the Orientation Center and the Blindness Skills Instructors in the Independent Living Program to provide Step 2020 virtual training to the 28 student participants in the Step program in the areas of orientation and mobility or cane travel. I supervise two of those staff. And in Albuquerque and in Santa Fe, we are probably providing most of that training, collaborating with Daphne, ensuring that consumers have signed their consent forms, making sure that consumers who are adults and who are still living with their families or receiving some form of support from their families are talking with their families before consenting. And really, we need that to happen on a lesson by lesson basis, because we know that as this virus has a mind of its own, we're needing to make sure that people are maintaining comfort while they understand and assess risk. So we are trying to provide both the lessons in the morning, although knowing with the two instructors and about the 12, 15 students that we have, that's not always going to be possible, and making sure that, and especially if we would like a student to receive a lesson once a week. In home management, as Lucy said, we are doing home management. We are actually trying to be certain that that we're doing that by video, at least in the Skills Center, and I believe that's happening elsewhere too. And that allows, one of the bright spots is that allows us to be, that kind of forces the parents to become involved, and then we're able to kind of talk to the parents about hand over hand technique, and know that the parent, and describe it for them, and know that they're able to coach their student through that. And what I'm hoping that helps us do is helps us to raise the expectations of our students. Students tend to, we've talked about this in our personal management classes with that instructor's group as well, is that there tends to become an expectations cliff. And I think O&M is helping with this too, because they're able to talk about what are the parents expecting from their student this summer. Their student has expressed a particular concern. What can they do to mitigate that? What are the expectations? So, you know, because what happens is that parents they expect the child to do well in school, and then there's an expectations kind of cliff with home things and with life management and those sorts of things. And I think it's just because that they, you know, the school help is there, and, you know, there's IEPs, there's the whole thing. It's a different communication form. So we're able to implement that communication with the parents. And so I hope that is a bright spot of the virtual instruction this summer. So we are, again, doing home management, orientation, mobility, personal management, Braille, and assistive technology. So again, we're using phone and video conference, and where it's applicable, and in technology, if we can, at least in the Skills Center, we're using JAWS Tandem, which is actually a good augment to Braille lessons if we can get when we can get a student a Braille display either.
Did we lose Kelly?
I think we may have. So
we do understand the virtual instruction because we did, or we did. I'm sorry, Greg.
I'm sorry, Kelly. We lost you for a few seconds there, but you're back. Keep going.
So we do understand. We do understand the in-person instruction. In fact, that actually was clarified for us fairly early, because because as I did report previously, there were some students that we were not going to be able to serve. And so, you know, it's STEP is kind of the great experiment between the virtual and the in-person instruction. And while the Skills Center, we work to be flexible at all times. And so we do understand that there is a potential that virtual instruction may continue. But as we look to open up, we'll be following the governor's guidelines along with Greg's as well as maintaining social distancing throughout our building as the Skills Center is joined to the Albuquerque office. So I look forward to any questions that you might have.
Mr. Chair, it's Urja. Excuse me. Kelly, I'm curious, so far, how are the parents responding to the opportunity to participate?
You know, I have not gotten any negative reports regarding that. It's been fairly positive. And we do have some parents who are working, and some students who are adults that we're doing home management via video conference, for instance. And so that, you know, and we could do it by phone as well. But, you know, one of the things about video conference is that we're able to and ask questions along the way. but you know, making sure that everybody stays safe. But parents have responded well to being able to participate. And I hope that though that is a bright spot, we can maybe expect that everybody's going to become fatigued and that we might not experience that in the future. But I do hope it's mm-hmm. I do hope continue. It's a different thing. Yeah.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
Any questions, Ms. Kelly? Okay. Thank you, Kelly. You still have more?
I do not. I'm done. We are continuing our Technology for Children program, by the way. So that's, and I just wanted to let you know. I just wanted to let you know that. And Greg, it has a real stress on that. We're stressing that because as schools reopen with the uncertainty, we've heard that schools are either going to go to a hybrid schedule or a virtual schedule or a school or an in-class schedule. And parents, depending on their needs or the needs of their child, may be picking from that menu. So the Technology for Children program will increase in its importance as we go.
Sure will.
Definitely, and you'll hear more about that for our next item, Mr. Commissioner. So that's probably a good transition. So I'll let Urcha say what that is, and then we can move on unless there are more questions.
Thank Mr. You. Chair, we've moved on to item 8, unfinished business, and A is the report from the Commission on the coronavirus emergency.
Okay, Greg.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. As we've kind of mentioned briefly a couple of times, most of our employees are continuing to telework, the large majority. We do have essential employees who are coming to the office. Those essential employees are really doing work that enables those who are able to telework to perform that. It also helps us to be compliant with our federal rules and regulations. If we weren't able to provide services, then we would not be able to bill to our VR grants. So we have to still be able to function in a reasonable way. So I really do thank all of our employees, those who are teleworking and those who are able to report to the office. We also have some folks who do a little bit of both. And we're certainly making sure that everyone is safe there. We have ordered a couple batches of masks, or several. We've got the first of those in. Hopefully the other batch has come in or will arrive here soon. We've distributed those. We've actually, I guess, gotten three if we count the Department of Correction masks. So Kevin was able to find masks from the Department of Corrections. Those are a little heavy duty. I think we really are wanting to find masks that will work well. We want to be cognizant of the fact that for things like cane travel and outdoors, wearing a mask is an additional factor of concern. We want people to be able to be cool. And if you're wearing a face mask, that has a real impact. So we're watching very, very closely the weather for our orientation mobility instruction. I'll have Jim talk more about that as far as our O&M lessons. Lucy mentioned that a little bit. We have created category 34 of Newsline, as I mentioned during the last board meeting. We continue to populate that with new news stories, trying to focus on those stories that offer really helpful information, offer creative tips, make sure we're providing really cutting edge information that our Newsline readers can access. We did stop our Newsline volunteers from coming to the office. Krista has now put together a proposal for how we can have some of the volunteers to start to come back. Obviously, we'll do that in a very prudent and safe fashion. Krista and Richard have been reading Newsline. We do consider that to be an essential service. So they have been coming to the office to do that. We are making sure that we have hand sanitizer available. We mentioned in the last meeting that Raymond had taken a special training focused on COVID-19, as did staff in Alamogordo. So Jim, do you want to take it from there and talk a little bit more in detail about what we're doing?
Sure. So in terms of our STEP program, as Greg mentioned, we are doing some orientation mobility training. I think Kelly mentioned it a little bit in her report as well. And so yes, we are taking some pretty significant precautions in that respect. Number one, there's a longer kind of questionnaire for the students and regarding themselves and family members and things like that, that gives us a baseline. And then as far as the each particular visit, now Greg, you're wanting me to talk about the screening questions or more the vehicle?
Yeah, well, both. The consent form, the screening that we're doing, you know, obviously commissioners, we are being very, very careful here. So we are providing cane travel lessons under our STEP program. Part of the reason for that is because if you're not maintaining those cane travel skills, you can lose those. And if you lose those skills, as Lucy described earlier, the consequences can be tragic. And those are not being provided by the school. And we also have new rules about social distancing. So I think there's a real imperative that we provide these services and do it in a safe way. So Jim, go ahead and take
sure. it. Sure, okie doke. So as Greg mentioned, you know, we do have a consent form that spells out a lot of the reasons why we want to continue providing the cane travel lessons, the importance of the cane travel lessons, and again, what the expectations would be that the individual consumer, if they're an adult, again, these are all pre-employment transition services, age 14 through 21. So if they're 18 through 21, basically they're an adult. They can make their own decision with input certainly from their family. But for those that are under 18, then we certainly are going to need their parents to sign off in terms of the consent. And again, it does ask some basic information about some of their exposures and travel and symptoms and things like that. But prior to each lesson, again, say throughout the June and July, throughout the period of the STEP program, they would need to complete a screening survey. And there's three main pieces to the screening survey. One addresses symptoms. The second addresses travel. So where they have been in the state, have they been out of state, have they been traveling internationally? And the third section deals with exposures. So themselves or family members being exposed to others with a positive COVID-19 test. And so our basic position is that if they answer, and they're yes, no questions, and if a yes, they have an opportunity to explain, but our position is that if they have a yes answer to any of those three questions, then we cancel that lesson. And so the screening is going to be either, say, late afternoon for an early morning lesson the following day, or it might be that same day for a later morning or afternoon lesson. So we would cancel that lesson, and the opportunity to explain their yes answer, we would then be able to follow up with additional questions, follow up with calls to the Department of Health coronavirus helpline and talk to a medical professional about any particular questions that might have been brought up as far as the screening. So now the screening is a two-way street. So we want to know about the consumer's symptoms and travel and exposure. And they want to know about our staff symptoms and travel and exposure. And so so our staff would have to complete the same kind of screening form. So it's an O&M instructor, or in some cases, again, if we have a blind staff member and they're having a driver that is transporting them and then ultimately transporting the consumer to a lesson location, then the screening would apply to the driver as well. So again, we're wanting to make sure that they feel that they, the consumer and their family, feel comfortable that we're not bringing the virus to them as well. And then when it comes to the vehicles themselves, we actually have at least two vehicles assigned to each instructor, so that they're able to, say, use vehicle A on Monday morning, and on Tuesday have vehicle A cleaned, and have a second vehicle available for them on Tuesday. And then that vehicle would be cleaned on Wednesday. The vehicle that they used on Monday would now be available on Wednesday for them to use. So, and in the meanwhile, after the use, the vehicles are wiped down, all the hard surfaces are wiped down, and we have hand sanitizer available in each of the vehicles for the instructors, drivers, consumers, you know, all to use as well. And of course, masks. No, we have extra masks. If the consumer, say, we go to pick them up and they come out of their home without a mask, they say, sorry, I lost my mask or came apart, then we're going to always have extra masks available to be able to provide to them. So I think we're taking some very prudent precautions in trying to ensure that that nobody is exposed, and that we're still able to provide that very essential training that our consumers need in terms of cane travel training.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, just want to go into a little more detail on the consent form. I think it's really important that the consent be informed, so we really laid out the risks of COVID-19 to the individual student, to the student's family. We discussed some of the risk factors, what puts an individual at higher risk for COVID-19. We also even mentioned the multi-system inflammatory disease, which has been found in younger children. That's part of the detail. You know, we want the parents and our consumers to really know so that they can weigh, is this something we want to participate? Do I have a household member that if I become infected could be exposed? What is the risk of that? So we are really being extra careful here with all of what we're doing. So, but there are other things that Jim can talk about. We've got our wellness checks. And so, Jim, I think you had a couple more things you're going to mention.
Sure. So as far as the wellness checks, again, I think we had briefed the commission during the April meeting about that particular initiative where we had contacting the current VR and IL consumers, in addition to VR and IL consumers that had been closed in the previous 5 years. And again, and I think that was a very effective initiative. It was very well appreciated by our consumers. And some of them certainly, some of them did not need any other resources that we had available to discuss with them, but some of them certainly did, and they all very much appreciated the call. Just even that one call made a big difference for them, that we were kind of looking out for them and concerned about their well-being. So I think that went very well. Let's see, and then you talked about.
So we have the what we're doing to support school students, public school students through the VR program.
Oh sure, yeah. Yeah, and again, this was something I think we had briefed during the April meeting, but that was the initiative to make sure that those, mainly the high school students, we surveyed the college students as well, but for the most part, the college students have the gear that they need, computers, assistive technology, and internet service. The bigger void and bigger gap was for the high school students that were now needing to access their school district learning management system. And so we tried to, as quickly as possible, survey those high schoolers for make sure they had a computer. And again, different students use different computers and are comfortable with different computers, but it could have been a Windows-based computer, could have been a Mac, and some school districts actually distributed Chromebooks to their students. And so there are quite a number of folks that had Chromebooks. And then, of course, they needed assistive technology, and so we tried to make sure that they had that technology. Macs, of course, have built-in technology, assistive technology. Chromebooks have built-in assistive technology in terms of screen readers and screen magnifiers. Windows computers, we typically are going to be providing JAWS or Fusion or a product like that. So, and then the other big issue, of course, was internet access. So some families, of course, have broadband service in their homes. That no sweat on those. But for consumers that don't have broadband service in their home, then we needed to try to quickly get access for them, either through a program like Comcast Essentials, which was really a great value. I think it's approximately $10 a month. And that was available to some students. And for other students, it just depended on if they had something that we could expand on. So maybe they had a basic data plan on their cell phone, and we were able to pay for expanded data, a data plan that included a personal hotspot or et cetera for their to be able to connect. So we looked at a number of different possibilities and were able to kind of, I think, fill in the gaps pretty well for our high school students, again, as far as hardware, assistive technology, and internet access. So I think that worked pretty well. And as a result of that, the students who were going to be participating in STEP, they were going to need exactly the same kind of tools to access virtual STEP. So that dovetailed pretty well into that those students participating in STEP and having the right gear available to participate in virtual STEP.
Greg, do we have enough to send the commissioners a couple of masks?
I think we could certainly do that. I think it's important. I had the Department of Corrections mask brought to me because I wanted to take a look at it, and I appreciate our partners over at the Department of Corrections and the job that they're doing to try to step in, but I felt that their mask wasn't really quite what we were looking for. It didn't quite meet our needs, so I think it would really help the commissioners to know that the masks that we're providing do meet our consumers' needs. So absolutely, we will send you each a couple so you can see what we're providing and how we're using them.
Yeah, for example, now when I was at the VA, they ripped my mask off and said, throw that thing away. It's not here, and then gave me another mask. They never explained why they thought that I didn't have a good mask, but they never explained that.
That's really interesting. The recommendation is for cloth masks, not the N95 masks, and really those are being discouraged. The thinking is that the N95 masks need to be saved for health professionals. You know, certainly you're going to a healthcare setting. I could understand how they might want you to wear a mask that has a little greater protection. But yeah, in terms of being out in the streets, in places of public, their recommendation is for a face mask that's made of cloth. You know, there are definitely different levels of quality and protection that are out there. But, you know, we're really thinking of the students that need to be out there with orientation mobility lessons. And that's not the best time to be using a mask that is really, really restrictive. So, you know, the CDC even talks about just wearing a bandana. You know, their main concern is that you want to catch that cough or that sneeze. And by having a simple face mask on that's made of cloth, you keep that cough or that sneeze from projecting viral particles out there. Of course, we have a physician on board. So Dr. Reedy, if you want to join in on any of this, feel free. But I'd be glad to send that out there, send the masks to the commissioners.
Thank you.
I think that would be instructive for us to see what we're utilizing. And I think that you're absolutely right that as a general rule, almost anything is useful. And then in high risk settings, you actually need a much more effective filter, but they're very restrictive and some of them are really a chore. So the efficacy of the mask is contingent on the person wearing it. It's got to be comfortable and non-restrictive.
I think that's a real, real good point. And actually, it's part of why we shortened our screening questionnaire. Yeah, you want to have something that's usable that people will be compliant with, both our staff and our students. So when we had a 3-page questionnaire, you get to have a little fatigue factor and people become less compliant. So we got a shorter questionnaire, but likewise with the masks, if they're so uncomfortable, people just won't wear them. So we really are trying to find masks that are comfortable. So I'm not sure what the status of our other order is. I had asked Jim to look into that yesterday. Jim, I don't know if you had a chance, or Monday if you had a chance to do that.
I did not. I'm sorry, this morning I didn't.
That's all right. So we'll follow up. Trish, I don't know if you know, we had, there was a mask that Sarah had identified that Krista was using, so we want to make sure that that those have been ordered as well, so that we can give people an option. But I'd really like to hear feedback from the commissioners. So,
Greg, those were ordered in that, and I believe they're the ones that came in. She said that they looked different. I think what it was is that the vendor we purchased from may have changed their vendor, their person that was making the masks. Okay. So there was a little bit of difference in appearance, but it was the one that Krista had ordered.
Right. Right. Well, we will certainly send those to the commissioners and we can then come back and discuss at the next meeting.
Okay. Thank you. Next item, Mirja.
Is the report on students in transition to employment program. That's Greg, Jim, and Kelly.
So we've talked about a fair bit. Jim, Kelly, do you want to kind of give us a little bit of update? We might have sufficiently covered it, but what do you guys think?
I feel like I've sufficiently covered it from my end.
Jim?
All righty, just a few items. We do have, again, 30 students this summer, which is pretty typical in a typical summer. This is not a typical summer, but that's, I guess, one of the few things that is typical about the same number of students. And we have the Central Region Education Cooperative, which is, of course, very involved, along with our Kelly's crew and Lucy's crew and some of our independent living teachers, as far as delivering the content using Google Classroom for a lot of the course materials and assignments and those types of things, and Zoom for the instruction. Rec 5, again, the Central Region Education Cooperative, they're handling the career development, job exploration, counseling, post-secondary education opportunities, some of those kind of components of the program. And Lucy and Kelly and our independent living teachers are handling more of the blindness skills component. We certainly talked about cane travel quite a bit. just one last item as far as employment, which is of course typically a significant part of the summer training and an employment program. This year we do have three of the students have jobs, and one is working with an uncle in Arizona. The uncle is an electrician, and so this consumer is an electrician helper. We have a student whose mom works for a law firm, and this student wants to be a lawyer and is working in an office assistant kind of paralegal-ish capacity. And the third student actually is a student who's working in an office assistant type of a job with a construction company, and the Rec 5 job developer helped to secure that placement last summer. So the employer was so happy to have this student, and the student was so happy to be there, that the employer asked if the student would continue working during the school year in an after-school capacity, and so the student did. And so now the student was able to kind of continue into that with the same job this summer. And since construction is one of those essential functions that really didn't slow down during the stay-at-home order, the student was able to continue working. So that really worked out really nicely for that particular student. And so, Mr. Trapp, Mr. Chairman, that's all I have.
Thank you, Jim.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have anything else here. We're certainly doing our best to continue to provide the program. I really applaud Lucy and Kelly and Jim for the work they've done, and Daphne Mitchell to really make this successful. It's been difficult, but I think that they've really done a great job. And we still have to spend the Priets reserve. We'll talk more about that later. But we are continuing to serve our consumers in a very, very best possible way.
Okay, next item.
Item C is a report on the submission of our combined state plan.
All right. So, Mr. Chairman, this was another of those things that was really a difficult process and very, very different this year. So, Jim,
Jay,
why don't you
explain, we will do Greg, the, what yeah. happened at the last minute.
So, we had a request that came in from the federal government. Jim, do you remember what date that was on?
8th
of June. Here it is, a Monday.
Monday.
So they requested us to make changes in, was it 12 different changes?
I think there were 12.
Right.
12
yeah.
categories,
so we had,
or 12
we
sections.
Had 12 sections that we had to make changes in, and they asked us to get it done by close of business that same day. They're very apologetic about it. I did my best with my negotiating skills, and I managed to get about a 4-hour extension to noon the next day. But it was a challenge. So, Jim, why don't you give us a little more detail about what they were asking there and what we got done?
So this is actually, it's very common when you submit a 95-page, you know, state plan and over quite a number of different sections and we would typically get a response from our RSA liaison within a couple of weeks after the submission to identify, we'll just say 12 items, and that's not uncommon. But they usually give us a week or two to get it done. And so that's normal, that's usual. It just happened that in this particular case, we submitted this in March, and so nothing in April, really one little bitty item, well, a couple of items in April and May regarding some of the measurable skill gain targets, but we were expecting that. And one other little item related to some population estimates in May, but we got this request that Greg just described in June, and June the 8th, and really they wanted it done that day because their own internal deadline for RSA was that Wednesday, so the 10th. Again, Greg was able to negotiate till noon on on the 9th. And you mentioned, I was chuckling, Greg, as you mentioned that that gave us four extra hours. Well, that's four extra work hours. You know, we were all working on it Monday evening.
Monday evening, right.
To get it done, to meet the deadline. So so that was the part that wasn't, that was a very unusual, is the is waiting until the very, I mean, the very last minute to ask us to get it done, and which we were able to do. And again, thanks to Sarah, who helped us. The portal this year was not very screen reader friendly, was really difficult to navigate. So Sarah helped us get the information in, and John Casado over at Department of Workforce Solutions, he had a particular role where he needed to be able to push a button to approve it before it went to the federal government for their review. So he was involved in the process of approving at the state level. And so we were fortunate enough, again, to be able to work with RSA. And again, even after we got that in, they still identified one last little item, which, again, is only a matter of somebody different looking at it, because it had been in there for at least 10 years, you know, this little item. And it wasn't really, it wasn't that significant from our point of view, and it had passed through for a number of years, but somebody different looked at it. They decided it was important enough to change. So again, even after we got those 12 items in, section items in, we had to go back in and take out four letters to kind of satisfy RSA. So that, and which again, we were able to do. So we got it in by their deadline. They met their deadline, and we got an approval day or two later that the plan had been approved. So all's well that ends well.
It was, the changes were pretty technical. You know, fortunately, we didn't have to go out for public comment or anything like that. There were things that the commission owned. You know, they were wanting us to specify when did we sign our memorandum of understanding with the public education department, information about cooperative agreements. But Jim and I put in a very, very late night that evening getting this done. They'd given DVR a whole week. They had made the request of them the prior Tuesday. So I'm not sure what happened there, but we got it done. And I think actually our plan is quite good. Overall, the changes were still fairly minor, but they just didn't give us the usual couple of weeks to get it done.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, Mr. Chairman, that's it for the update on the state plan. It's in, it's good, it's approved. The whole plan for the state was approved by the feds. So we are good to go here. That will take effect on July 1st.
Good deal. All
right. Greg, do we have to do that every year?
Bob, that's a great question. It used to be that we did. And in one of the partners meetings, Jim and I and Kelly were sitting there, and John Casados came up and was talking to us about the state plan. And he asked us, how many state plans have we done? And Jim and I kind of thought, well, you know, I said, well, I think 16 or 17. And he was a little dumbfounded because, you know, there now where it's a four-year cycle with an update kind of midstream. So, yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why we're able to get this done so well. Jim and I have been doing this for 21 years, which is much more experience than anyone else has here in New Mexico, by quite a bit.
Right. Okay, Urja.
Item D is the approval of the Open Meetings Act resolution providing procedures to hold meetings, public meetings, during times of emergency. And I admit, Mr. Chair, I did not repeat the, is it SRC? No. CFR number. And Art Schreiber is our presenter.
All right. I'm going to rely on John and Greg to get us through all of this. So this is really something that we have taken the lead on, in my opinion, and we still, as you probably know, our first item was even put on the website of FOG, a Foundation for Open Government. I still don't think they did enough in explaining to other agencies that hey, take a look at what the Commission for the Blind did. But go ahead, Greg and John.
And Mr. Chairman, I did contact Melanie Majors with FOG this week just to follow up. So that is on their webpage. So we certainly appreciate the work that the Foundation for Open Government does. So our Open Meetings Act resolution, as you will recall, we had this on the agenda at our April 16 meeting. And Mr. Kreinkamp developed some additional language, which he sent to me on the 17th, and I thought his language was great. I added kind of my own little perspective to it. So we're proposing to add under section 17, one additional paragraph for how we will meet once we start to have in-person meetings. We're going to be dealing with this situation for a long time. There will likely be limits on public gatherings and social distancing required. So we've got an additional paragraph F there. We also added under section 14 language about our public meetings. So it gets a little bit confusing. So we have commission meetings, that's what's taking place today, of the Commission for the Blind Act. But under federal law, when we make changes to policies, practices, procedures, we have to go out and conduct public meetings. Those public meetings are not covered by the Open Meetings Act. They're not meetings of the commission or the council. They're ones that that I might go out, or Kelly might, or Jim might. We've all done them in different parts of the state, providing notice to the public about those changes in policies and procedures. They've got to be substantive, but there's a federal legal provision under 2 CFR 361.20B2 that says if you don't have state law that specifies procedures for Open Meetings Act, for procedures for public meetings, then the agency in consultation with the Rehab Council needs to adopt procedures. So our council has done that. That took place yesterday. So what we're proposing to do here is to mirror that. And we also are specifying the amount of notice for those public meetings. And I think 72 hours is appropriate. That ties to the notice for special meetings. We also normally have to do those meetings during the winter. That's when the state plan is typically due. And we want to be aware of weather. And with the really accurate 10-day forecast now, we can say, hey, can we schedule a public meeting in Farmington on December 17th? And have time to publish notice and get the word out. So, and we would, again, it's at least 72 hours. So that's important. We also are proposing one additional change to the citation for how we keep the records of recordings, and that's in section 17, paragraph E. So what I'd like to do at this point is to have Kelly read paragraph F. Kelly, you've got that. Are you ready?
Actually, I need Trish to read it. My The technology is arguing with me, and I need to come up with a better system of doing this. So I apologize for my improficiency.
We're all dealing with technology. So I know that both John and Trish have that at the ready.
I've got it ready. Yesterday you asked me to read all of 17. Do you want me to read just F?
I just want you to read F. For the commission, that's the only change.
Okay. F.
Well, actually, that's not exactly totally correct. The commission had the bulk of the language in section 17. It was section 14 for the Rehab Council, but the commission adopted the language in section 17 during our April 16 meeting. We've got two changes. One is the addition of paragraph F, which you're going to read right now. So go ahead, Trish.
Following the conclusion of a state of emergency as declared by the governor, and should limits on public gathering remain in place, or should public health officials discourage public gatherings or otherwise recommend that social distancing be maintained, the commission may place reasonable limits on the manner in which the public attends public meetings, provided that all interested individuals are afforded a reasonable opportunity to attend or participate. This may include requiring persons attending the public meeting to maintain a specified distance from others present at the meeting. The commission shall enable public access through telephonic or video webcast for any meeting at which such limitations are imposed. The commission shall, in the meeting notice, provide the public with information as to any in-person limitations, as well as information on how the meeting may be accessed remotely.
Great. So John, do you want to comment further on that? I think that was really great language that you came up with there. I think we really refined that. I think it's a good proposal. So, John?
Yeah, I don't really have too much to add. I mean, I think it's, I think the language itself makes it clear what it's aimed at. I mean, the idea was that the resolution that we had previously adopted was arguably slightly incomplete insofar as we knew what we were going to do when there were these social distancing orders that were in place, but we didn't really address how we were going to deal with a relaxation of those social distancing orders. And, you know, I think that the expectation, at least my expectation, and I think that Greg sees it the same way, is that we can sort of expect for a while now, it's sort of going to yo-yo a little bit in terms of how strict those social distancing measures are. And so we wanted to have language that was in place so that we could remain sort of ahead of the curve in terms of how we were going to handle, you know, if the governor, you know, maybe relaxed it a little bit and allowed gatherings of, you know, a smaller number of people, but not a large number, you know, how the commission might react to that in terms of holding its meetings. So I think that this language does a nice job of clarifying how the commission would handle that.
And Mr. Chair, commissioners, we also are proposing to add a citation to Part 200, which is our federal fiscal rules. So the last sentence of paragraph E of section 17 says, as it is now, that we'll retain the recordings of these meetings for 3 years. I'd written that thinking of the federal records retention law, but realized afterwards that there's a little bit of a nuance there because it's 3 years from the close of the, 3 years from the submission of the grant closing the federal fiscal year. So it's a little bit more than 3 years. So we've got a proposal to refine that a little bit. John, would you read that sentence, please?
Yes, let me pull that up. The new sentence would say, the commission shall maintain a copy of the recording for a period in compliance with the federal regulations at 2 CFR 200.333, and as may otherwise be required by state retention laws, and make the recording available as may be required by the inspection of public record.
So, Mr. Chairman, in addition to those two changes, as I mentioned earlier, we've added additional language under Section 14 that talks about how we will conduct public meetings. That language pretty much mirrors the language of 17, which we had adopted previously. The difference is that we don't make recordings of those public meetings, so we would not be keeping that language. Also, it specifies 72 hours, and it talks about the kind of notice that we provide. We did send that out. It's not terribly long. I could have Trish or John read Section 14. If you would like, it's totally up to you. I think this is new language under 14, so it probably would be a good idea just to read that here.
Sure. You ready?
Ready.
Conducting public meetings prior to the adoption of substantive policies or procedures governing the provision of vocational rehabilitation services. A, prior to the adoption of any substantive policies or procedures governing the provision of vocational rehabilitation services under the combined state plan, including making any substantive amendments to policies and procedures, the Commission for the Blind will conduct public meetings throughout the state to provide the public, including individuals with disabilities, an opportunity to comment on policies or procedures. B, at least 72 hours prior to any public meeting, the public meeting shall be advertised in a newspaper of general circulation, posted to the Commission webpage, placed on Newsline, provided to disability advocacy groups representing individuals who are blind, and distributed as may otherwise be appropriate. The public meetings may include town forums, town halls, or other public meetings organized by the Commission. C, should limits on public gathering be in place due to a declaration by the governor of a state of emergency, the public meetings may also include meetings that take place telephonically or by video webcast, provided that each such meeting is specifically directed to and associated with a particular geographic area of the state. The Commission shall enable public access to any meeting at which such limitations are imposed through telephonic or video webcast means. The Commission shall, in the notice of such a meeting, provide the public with information as to how the meeting may be accessed remotely. The notice shall specifically state that the purpose of the meeting proposed, meeting is to provide persons who reside in the area with an opportunity to comment on the proposed policies or procedures. In addition to the notice requirement set forth in subsection B, the Commission shall also advertise the public meeting in a newspaper that is located in the area, provided the notice to affiliates or chapters located in the area of disability advocacy groups representing individuals who are blind, provide the meeting notice to Center for Independent Living that serves the area, post the meeting notice in the Commission office that is in the area, provide the notice to any American Indian vocational rehabilitation projects that serve the area, and conduct such outreach as would otherwise be appropriate if the meeting was being held in a physical location in the area. D, following the conclusion of a state of emergency as declared by the governor, and should limits on public gathering remain in place, or should public health officials discourage public gatherings or otherwise recommend that social distancing be maintained, the Commission may place reasonable limits on the manner in which the public attends public meetings, provided that all interested individuals are afforded a reasonable opportunity to attend or participate. This may include requiring persons attending the meeting, the public meeting, to maintain a specific specified distance from others present at the meeting. The commission shall enable public access through telephonic or video webcast for any meeting that at which such limitations are imposed. The commission shall, in the meeting notice, provide the public with information as to any in-person limitations, as well as information on how the meeting may be accessed remotely.
Thank you, Trish. So, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, I think what we've done here is really a model. We have shared this, and it has been shared by the technical, by WinTAC, one of the technical assistance centers. The language that our Rehab Council adopted yesterday. That language is basically what we're proposing to adopt today for the commission. So unless there are any further conversations, or John, is there anything else you want to add? We probably a little bit unique in the amount of effort that we make to make sure that we are accessible both under our federal law and state law. Want to make sure that we are open and transparent.
No, I don't have anything else to add. I mean, the commission's doing a really good job of staying ahead of the curve and making sure that it's, meeting requirements are up to date. So I encourage the commission to, adopt the amended language.
And we certainly take our leadership from Chairman Schreiber, who is a great proponent of openness in government. So Art, we appreciate your lead on this and all you've done in this area. So thank you. And I think we might have lost Art. All right, so, Arthur. All right, Art, we have discussed the Open Meetings Act resolution. We have summarized the changes to paragraph 14, adding the 72 hours notice. We have discussed and read the addition to paragraph 14 of how we will conduct meetings during the coronavirus emergency. We've talked about the addition of the citation to the last sentence of section 17E, and we've read the last paragraph that we're proposing to add on how we conduct meetings when times of social distancing are in place, and we are ready for a motion to approve the Open Meetings Act resolution, and complimented you as our leader and the direction and importance that you place on this. So we are ready for a vote.
Mr. Chair, this is Urja.
All right, go ahead.
I move to approve the Open Meetings Act resolution to include the provisions for holding meetings during times of state emergencies.
All this right. Is Bob, I second.
Bob is second. Any further discussion? All those in favor, roll call, Urja Lansing.
Yes.
Bob Reedy.
Yes.
Art Schreiber, yes. All three in the affirmative. And thank you, Urja.
All right, so we're ready for the next item, Urja.
It's an update on the policy for authorization of,
our policy under the Families First Coronavirus Response
for
Act.
The one for exempt employees. I'm spacing out. I'm so sorry.
Urja, you're doing great. So,
Mr. Leave, that's the word, Greg, leave. Authorization of leave for exempt employees.
Right. So, Mr. Chairman, as you will recall, we had approved at the April 16 policy, which would have had the State Personnel Office approving leave for our exempt employees. We do have employees in exempt other positions. And Art, I'm not sure you were our first chairman back in 1986. I'm not sure if you recall how those EXOT positions came to be, but they were initially for our old industries for the blind.
So I'm not,
right. So we still have a few of those positions, and they do some very important work. There are reader drivers. We need the exempt positions for them because we want to make sure that we can properly accommodate our blind staff, and having the flexibility of the exempt position is really important for that. It's also important for us to comply with our PREATS mandate, and it's important for us to have safe coverage at the orientation center in Alamogordo. So after our meeting on the 16th, the State Personnel Office really took another look at this, and they decided that they did not have the authority beyond the classified employees. So they referred us to the state, to the Department of Finance and Administration. At the April 23rd meeting, the commission voted and authorized me to develop a policy, knowing that we would not be able to implement what had been approved at the April 16 meeting. So since April 23rd, I've been in contact with Debbie Romero, who is the acting secretary of the Department of Finance Administration. We have come to an agreement whereby the agency, that is myself, we will make recommendations for the approval of leave under the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. For anyone who has any of the six qualifying conditions, we'll make a recommendation to the Department of Finance Administration, who will approve the leave or deny the leave as may be required under federal law. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the update. We've got in place now a procedure for approving leave for our exempt employees. To give you an illustration real quickly, if we have an employee whose school is, whose has a son or daughter that's in school and their school's been closed, or if they have a disabled adult child and their place of care has been closed, that individual can be eligible for leave under the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. There are also exposure and people who have been advised to quarantine because they're infected. So there are six different circumstances. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the update.
Thank you. Okay, any questions, any comments? Okay, next item.
We're moved on to item 9, new business, Mr. Chair. A is the approval of the acceptance of transfer of assets from Hill Vending to the commission, and I did not read the entire item, and I'm going to ask Kevin and or Greg to fill it in, please.
Well, Kevin's got this item. Kevin, do you want to read the agenda item, just so I think that defines what we're doing?
Sure. The agenda item reads, approval of acceptance of transfer of assets from Hill Vending, consisting of vending machines located at Los Alamos National Laboratory, as fair and full compensation for the balance due to the commission for the operation of the Los Alamos route by Hill Vending. That's the agenda item. The background information for the commission to be aware is after discussions with Hill Vending, who ran the route at the Los Alamos National Laboratory under the auspices of the Commission's BP program. It was calculated that the vendor had not provided the necessary payments for set aside to the Commission. The vendor was informed of the amount calculated as what was due, and the vendor proposed to transfer the company assets, which is the vending machines located at the facility, to the control and ownership of the Commission. After discussion with DFA, with Mr. Kreinkamp, with Executive Director Trapp, we proceeded to move forward with an asset transfer and ownership agreement. This agreement stated that the assets, all the assets that were appraised by an independent third party, would be transferred to the ownership and control of the Commission for the stated amount of fair value of $52,425. The agreement was prepared, submitted to the vendor, and which the vendor signed on April 27th, and the Commission signed on April 21st of 2020, and at which point we took complete ownership of those machines at Los Alamos National Laboratories. Now, the reason this discussion comes forward is in conducting research into the particular vendor and the documentation that the Commission had to ensure that we were getting our fair and equitable portions that we're required to collect. It was determined that the rate the vendor was submitting varied. At one point, the vendor was submitting 10%. Keep in mind, this vendor was should have had an agreement we couldn't locate. The stated normal rate is 20%. So there was some discrepancy as to, you know, the amount actually owed to be calculated. We felt that it was best to have and base the agreement on the fair value assessment provided by an independent third party. We felt that was the best method to calculate the appropriate and accurate value of those machines. And so what we're asking the Commission is for approval that the, for a better lack of word of amount owed, is considered full and complete and fair valued at the agreed amount of $52,425. And we close this matter with Hill Vending in regards to the Los Alamos National Laboratory machines en route. Are there any questions?
Does this make us good, Greg?
Mr. Chairman, it does. I think also part of the value here, the valuable consideration from my perspective, is that the cost of moving machines in and out would be enormous. The difficulty of doing that, the disruption to service. So in addition to the value of the machines, there are other real values here that accompany this proposal, this asset transfer. Also, there are security issues when it comes to a facility like Los Alamos. And I think that these are existing machines which have been secured in terms of any threat to national security. If we were contracting from new machines that might be made in China, for example, that could be a real issue. So there are many, many ways in which this asset transfer works for the benefit of the state of New Mexico and the Commission for the Blind.
Okay.
Jim, Kevin, do you want to add anything? Jim is the BEP manager.
Can we make sure we didn't lose him?
I'm sorry, what was that?
I had asked Jim if he wanted to add anything about the vending machine transfer.
No, no, sir. I think this is a good resolution.
Kevin, anything else you wish to add?
No, I concur that this resolution is the best and most effective for the state and the commission. I think that this allows us the flexibility to continue to maximize the use of the VEP program, especially Los Alamos National Laboratory. As we're aware, it's a secure facility, so individuals who work there or happen to be there, you know, we kind of had the added benefit that they will use our machines. So I think that this comes out to the best advantage possible for the commission.
And John, is there anything that you'd like to add here?
No, I don't. I mean, I'll just let the commission know that I think over the past year or so, I'm not entirely sure. I don't exactly remember when this issue first arose, but you know, I worked with Greg and I think I spoke with somebody over at DFA about it at one point, you know, to ensure that this was being handled in the right way. And I do think that everything that should have been done was done. You know, they used an outside individual to appraise the value of these machines. So, you know, I don't really have anything to add beyond that.
All right.
May I ask one question? This is Bob Reedy. Who services those machines?
Dr. Reedy, that's a great question. I'll have Jim answer that.
So there's a company, again, Hill Vending used to be the company, that the third party that serviced those machines. And the gentleman who owned Hill Vending really, I think, lost a lot of interest in doing it. I think he had some health issues and just wasn't able to really kind of fulfill the requirement. And so he, in essence, kind of sold the business, his business, to another party. And so they've been kind of in the process of taking over the servicing of the machines. And so we've been working with them also and with Los Alamos National Laboratory to get them. They had some clearance to begin with. So that kind of gave them an advantage, but there's still just some other I's to be dotted and T's to be crossed to get to the kind of finish line with this other company. But and I imagine there are probably still some of the machines that are not being serviced right now, you know, that are in technical areas where these folks do not have security access. So, but we have the machines, so that's a really good outcome for us.
But the people who are actually servicing the machines are not clients of the commission.
Correct, they are not clients.
Right, and you know, we certainly do want to have our licensed blind managers running facilities like this, and we will make it available and do in case any licensed blind manager wants to operate this. This one is more challenging because of the issues related to security, but it kind of makes me wonder if there could be a teaming agreement that we could do here. We do want to make sure that we're providing every possible opportunity under the Business Enterprise Program for our blind clients. And we are looking for new opportunities, and we can report on that program in more detail at the next commission meeting. We've not done that. I think it'd be a great idea to do that. You know, hopefully, eventually, we will have a licensed blind manager running this facility.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, yeah.
And of course, it used to be Robert Vick, who was at Los Alamos, and he got his start there. I believe that was his first facility. Art, you would know better than I do.
Yes, that was his first facility. Well, you know, we moved him to a couple of places at Los Alamos. He started out in the basement of an office building. And then moved to another location, then ran a cafeteria at Los Alamos. And then he moved from there to the post office in Albuquerque.
Right, and you know, I wish we could clone folks like Robert Vick. There just aren't enough of them interested in these kinds of opportunities. The Randolph Shepherd Program was part of our history. It was passed in 1936. At that time, blind persons could not receive vocational rehabilitation services. So the Randolph Shepherd Act was literally the first employment program for blind persons. It was 1943 when blind persons were able to receive VR services for the first time, but that was not in a very equitable and appropriate fashion, which is why you have now separate agencies for the blind. We're very successful in helping blind people to get a whole variety of jobs. The Randolph Shepherd Program is a really critical, vital part of that. But because blind people have so many more opportunities today, not all of them are interested in opportunities like those that exist through the Randolph Shepherd Program.
Correct.
So, okay, Mr. Chairman, you need
a vote.
We do indeed.
Okay, this is for the approval of the...
Asset transfer.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, this is Urja.
Yes.
I move to approve the transfer of assets from Hill Vending to the commission. And if we need to fill that motion in, I'm open to it.
Kevin, what do you think? John?
Commissioner Lansing, I would suggest that in addition to accepting the asset transfer from Hill Vending to the commission, that the transfer is considered fair and full compensation for the balance owed to the commission for that particular route.
Thank you. For full and, sorry, Kevin.
Fair and full compensation.
Fair and full compensation.
For the balance due to the commission.
For the balance due to the commission.
Okay.
I hope somebody got that.
We got it. We're also still being recorded.
Oh, it's taped. Thanks, Greg.
All right. It's been moved by Urja.
This is Bob Reedy, and I second.
Bob Reedy second. A roll call vote. Urja?
Yes.
Bob Reedy?
Yes.
Yes. And Art Schreiber, yes. Passed unanimously. Move to the next item.
Item B is discussion of waivers proposed by the U.S. Department of Education. Greg Trapp.
Commissioner Lansing, thank you very much. This won't be a long item here, but it's becoming more important, and I thought that it merited some discussion here. So the Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, has proposed a set of waivers, and some of those deal with the vocational rehabilitation program. So far, Congress has not acted upon those waivers. The ones that are of greatest interest to us would waive the requirement to spend 15% of our VR grant on the provision of pre-employment transition services for the federal fiscal year 20 grant. That would really be a incredibly beneficial thing for us. We can't, as you've heard with the Prietz report and the STEP report, spend all of our 15% reserve. Schools are closed. We've only got three individual STEP consumers who are in employment right now, and that used to be really the largest part of our spending of PREET's reserves, paying for those salaries, paying for the assistants who help them on the job. So the opportunity to spend the PREET's reserve simply is gone. Because schools are closed, because we can't have gatherings, certainly we're going to see a huge amount of money that is reallocated back to the federal treasury. And the federal government is going to be looking at that here in July and August. And unless there is a waiver in place by early August, we'll see probably almost all or the vast majority of agencies relinquishing back to the federal government the PREET's money. So I'm really, really hoping that Congress, the House and Senate are going to be able to act upon those waivers. In addition to proposing to waive the FY20 PREET's reserve, another waiver would extend the period of performance for the federal fiscal year 19 grant. Now, we have long spent the non-PREET's portion of our federal fiscal year 19 grant. We had spent that by the end of October, early November. However, we have carried over the PREET's part of the federal fiscal 19 grant and will continue to be spending that. And the proposal would allow us to spend federal 19 funds for an additional year. So right now we're in federal fiscal 20. It's the carryover year for federal fiscal 19. The proposal would give us another year in which to spend the federal fiscal 19 PREET's reserve so that we could spend that money through September 30th of 2021. It's a very, very carefully, very cleverly thought through set of waivers there. I think the senior executive staff is obviously the folks who complied or compiled those waivers, and they would be incredibly beneficial. They're very, very, very well thought out. In addition, there's a proposed waiver that would also allow us to pay for new stocks for expired merchandise for the Randolph Shepherd vending program out of our VR grant. So hopefully Congress will move on those. I've been in contact with the governor's representative on federal matters. It's looking a little bit iffy at this point. We really, really need that federal fiscal 20 PREET's waiver. That would be essentially like giving us an additional $700,000 of regular VR funds. So we'll have to see what happens here. But Mr. Chair, that is my update. Go ahead, Kelly.
So I have a question, because if you relinquish the PREET's, you also have to relinquish part of the VR as well, because that would be a sanction?
Well, yes and no. So the reallotment process each year, states that cannot use all of their VR funds relinquish that back to the federal government, RSA. They then reallot the money to states that can use it. So this is kind of an oddity here. So what would happen would be that agencies would be unable to use the PREET's reserve. So RSA, if we relinquish the PREET's reserve back to RSA, hopefully that would then take on the character of a new set of funds that could be reallotted back to the state. So in doing that, It would again be 85% regular VR, 15% pre-ATS. So it would go through kind of a transformation process where the pre-ATS reserve would somehow come back as regular money. But part of what is likely to happen is that states are simply not going to be able to use all the money. So I think we'll see a huge amount of money relinquished across the country. And I think we'll see very few states in a position to request additional federal VR dollars. And there's a whole range of number of reasons for that. One of the recommendations that that we're making is that there be a waiver of the state match for the reallocated dollars, and that the pre-ATS requirement also be waived. So that's part of the NCSAB comments. If that happened, then the federal government would then be reallotting the money, treating it like the stimulus funds for the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, not requiring a match, and using the original grant formula allotment process. So great question, very complicated answer, very complex situation. We'll have to see what happens.
And actually, I should have been more clear, because I was thinking we would actually have to give up our, we would just automatically have to give up our state share in that as well, if we were able to, if we were just simply reallotting back our pre-ATS.
Well, and that's the no part of the answer, because if we can't use, if we can't spend all of the pre-ATS reserves, and Kevin, you can give us a more detailed answer, because that goes back to the federal reports as to how that gets indicated, but we would not have to give up any of our non-pre-ATS funds. If we can't spend any of our federal fiscal 20 pre-ATS reserves, that's what gets sent back to the government, none of our regular VR funds. We could face sanctions, but that's not going to happen at this time.
Right. And just to be clear, and I probably don't need to beat this to death if you don't feel that we're going to face sanctions, but, you know.
But please don't.
All right, I agree.
Okay, next item.
The next item, Mr. Chair, is Commission open comments. Discussion.
Okay, open comments. I mean, Bobby?
From the commission.
This is Bob. And I would just like to comment that I'm tremendously impressed with the thoroughness and the amount of work that the staff has done during this crisis. It's really formidable, and it speaks very well for the individuals and for the whole entity. And I thank you all very much.
I agree, Bob. Thank you.
And I'm totally in agreement with that, Mr. Chair, and how dedicated and stay a role model, and Greg taking the lead in so many things that's helping not only the Blind of New Mexico and other organizations, but also nationally.
Mr. Chair, Commissioners, thank you very much. We certainly have a great team, and we're all working very, very hard to make sure that we can provide the best possible services. Your support is really a critical part of our success, and we appreciate that.
Mr. Chair and Greg, I have a technical question, only because I'm going back to our meeting in April. There was some discussion, and I think we had a vote, regarding signature of any documents, perhaps from this meeting.
Yes, Commissioner Lansing, I appreciate that. We've kind of seen that as being a clerical issue, but it's a good question and we should follow up. So we've got the minutes that need to be signed. We've got the Open Meetings Act resolution that need to be signed. So at the last meeting, we took a vote on the operating budget because that required a physical signature. And that vote authorized either you or Commissioner Reedy to sign the operating budget. So I would refer to our Assistant Attorney General on the logistics here. Art, I think we can find a way for you to sign, or we could sign virtually. I know that there's been a little bit of difficulty getting your mail there at La Vida Yaena, and we had some other issues that came up that were a problem. So, John, what is your advice here?
So e-signatures are fine. What you have to do with those, if you want to execute Art's signature electronically, what you'll need to do is the documents that you want him to sign, you'll have to send them to him electronically with just ask him, may we affix your e-signature to it? He needs to, in writing through an email, confirm that you can affix his signature to it. At that point, what we do for most of our board orders that require the AAG to write them, what we do is we'll put /S/, Art Schreiber, and then you have to note underneath it, signature executed via electronic authorization dated whatever the date was. That's how we do it.
All right, and Art, you're having some computer difficulty right now.
Yeah, hopefully it'll be solved this afternoon.
All right, so if we email you these, and if it's solved this afternoon, you should be able to reply back and indicate your electronic signature. So I don't see a problem there. But if there is an issue with your computer, if they're a little deader than might be hopefully the case, then we will come up with a plan B. We'll figure this out.
Okay.
I think we can work this out. I don't think we have quite the same critical situation that we did back in April. And Art, it seems like the assisted living facility that you're in is slightly less strict than they were back in April.
Now, for example, they're allowing Mike Langner to come in and work on the computer right here.
Yeah, so we'll be able to get your signature then.
And he wears a mask and he answers a few questions. And I'm sure they take your temperature, but if no one is sick, they can come in.
All right, what time will Mike be there this afternoon? We might actually be able to get him the documents that he could take in and help you sign. That way we'd keep fewer people
I'm calling him here in probably the next 5 minutes and telling him that, the meeting will be over in, a half hour.
Well, I hope not that long. We'll be over before that. But I will ask Trish to coordinate Art with you, and we'll figure it out.
Okay. In fact, I'm going to put you on hold for a moment because I will call Mike.
Mr. Kreinkamp, this is Kevin. I got a question hopefully you could help with. Judging, since we're all still in this telework situation and obviously getting signatures is somewhat interesting at times, is there certain policies or rules that we could pass probably at the next commission meeting that would allow us to utilize electronic signature a little bit more effectively?
I mean, I haven't seen that done as an item of business, but I don't see any reason why you couldn't. I would think that, we can look at, the concern is having these meeting documents signed, or is it agency-wide?
Okay. He'll be here probably in an hour to an hour and a half.
All right. I think we should be able to get somebody over there who can have the document. So we'll coordinate with you on that, Art.
Okay.
Greg, would you like me to take him over?
We can have Araya do that. Or you? We don't have to figure this out right now. We'll figure that out offline.
Okay.
Okay, next item.
Number 11, comments from the audience.
Any comments, anybody?
So, Mr. Chairman, if we could go back to kind of the commission discussion, there was one other thing that while you were on hold, Kevin had asked about signatures. That does make me, remind me of something that I had discussed with Jim earlier in the week. And that is that I'd like us to come up with a confidentiality policy that we could sign as we're teleworking. So we have a lot of circumstances where we have employees that are at home, they have spouses or partners who are there with them. I think as a good best practice, having some protocol for handling confidential information, what one might overhear, how it's shared would be good. So there are a number of ways in which we could try to develop some refined techniques and procedures during this coronavirus, in addition to electronically signing documents. So perhaps at the next meeting, we can come back with a specific set of proposals that we can share and discuss with the board, if appropriate, have board approval on. So just a little bit more information there. And that is, you know, all that I have in terms of any additional comment.
Okay. Thank you. No comments from the audience, I assume.
And item 12 is date and time of next meeting, Mr. Chair.
Okay. What is your requirements, Greg?
So, Mr. Chairman, I think we've set the next date for August 26, if I recall correctly.
That is correct, sir.
And did we set that at 9 o'clock? I'm trying to recall. I did not write that down. Trish, would you look at the April 23rd minutes and just confirm that?
I had it scheduled for 10 o'clock.
10 o'clock, okay.
Well, that's just what I had down. 9 o'clock, I think is better.
Yeah, I think we should do 9 o'clock, too.
I do, too.
It gives us a little bit more time. Some of these meetings just take longer. So August 26th at 9 o'clock will be our next meeting.
Commissioners and Greg and fellow staff, just keep in mind the August 26th meeting, the FY22 budget request will be presented for signature as well.
Right, so we will need to figure out how to get that accomplished. So, and you'll need physical signatures on that.
Unfortunately, DFA documents still require actual signatures. I'm hoping the controller at some point realizes that electronic signatures may work, but at this point, they're still requiring originals.
You know, Kev, if we go back to your comment and adopt a more formal policy, that might help us. Maybe we could even have an attestation of signature that would be made under a penalty of perjury. I think that would be a really good way of addressing some of the DFA concerns. So shall we set the next meeting past August 26th, or my recommendation would be that we would actually, I'd like to see what kind of orders we have in place here. Did we set another meeting beyond August 26th at our last meeting? Let me look at my schedule. Yeah, I think we did too.
No, I don't believe that we did.
We don't. There's nothing more in the minutes.
All right. So do we want to set up a meeting in October or November. Probably November would be my recommendation. Or shall we just set the next meeting at the August meeting? I'm happy either way.
No, you think we can figure out a pretty good time for November right now?
I think it'd be good to mark it on our schedules.
Yeah. Are you talking about the early part of November, late, middle, late?
We could do middle October, middle November. I don't expect that we'll see an NCSAB or CSAVR conference that would normally be taking place there. I do want to try to avoid the possibility of it being during an LFC hearing, but who knows what that's going to be. So yeah. I would suggest either middle October or middle November, thinking that that would be a safe time.
Mr. Trapp, Chair,
yes.
I would actually suggest middle or even early October, because if we but probably more toward the middle, because if we have some semblance of what the LFC hearing is going to look like, we might be able to better strategize at that point.
Yeah, I would prefer October for the same reason.
All right, I'm very happy with that. We could do the 13th of October, which I think would be a Tuesday. The 11th, we could do the week before. October 17th, 7th, I think, is a Wednesday.
Yeah, that'd be better for me. Wednesday's better than Tuesday.
All right, why don't we do October 7th?
Okay.
Shall we do 9 o'clock? Uh-huh.
Yeah, okay, that's good.
Just in case, well, clearly either Zoom and phone or Albuquerque.
Ah, good question. Why don't we set it up for Albuquerque if there's an in-person meeting? And we will keep people posted. We don't know what we'll be doing.
Yeah. October 7th and still August 26th, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, sir. Both at 9 o'clock.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Item 13, adjourn.
All right. No final comments, anybody? This meeting is adjourned.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, thank you very much. Staff, John, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thanks to all of you.
Take care.
Thanks, Sergio. Thanks, Bob. Thanks, Art.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Red attachment, hard spasm, left bracket, RSBA dash announcement, red, Savannah Raymond, T, CFP, recall, left bracket, X, right bracket, red schedule, for X, agenda, virtual meeting commission for the blind June.